This is GamesAtWork.biz with Michael Martin and Michael Rowe, your weekly podcast about gaming technology and play. The thoughts and opinions on this podcast are those of the hosts and guests alone and not the opinions of any organization which we have been, are, or may be affiliated with.
This is episode 293, AR4K9. Hello, this is Michael Martin, co-host, along with my friend Michael Rowe of the fabulous and terrifyingly awesome GamesAtWork.biz podcast. Having a great time getting all of the feedback that we had from last week's episode, and I'm ready to go for this one. Michael, how about you? How are you today?
Oh, I'm really excited, and thanks again to Mark for being on the show with us last week, and getting us all excited about the elite world of Elite. I will confess I've not had a chance to play any of the newer Elites, let alone the older Elites, other than the one that was available through the browser. So very, very cool. It was an exciting time talking with Mark and Andy last week. And unfortunately, Andy's not joining the show this week. I guess he just was wiped out after totally geeking out on BBC computers and Elite last week.
No, I think
that could only be the reason.
I think he was drifting off, really, probably, is maybe what he was doing instead of being wiped
drifting.
Out. Yeah, drifting.
Yes.
Drifting.
Yes. Who else is drifting?
which is our first story of the week, actually, for all those lucky individuals, or maybe clever individuals, or folks that had money ready to go. And you needed to have a Nintendo Switch for this, too. So you had to be lucky to have that to start with. Mario Kart is out. Mario Kart Live is out. So you can set up a racetrack in your very own home and drive said little Mario Kart car around and have a ball doing it. And that's actually what Andy's doing right now. It's like, love to join you guys, but you know what?
Kind of busy. and you know, sometimes you just have to set your priorities.
Well, yes.
And I know Andy would love to be talking to you, our listeners, but sometimes you got to set those priorities.
Yeah. If you're playing an AR game, you got to play an AR game. And that's what this is. So if you don't know about Mario Kart Live, here's the deal. You get a little Mario Kart car. It is a little plastic thing. It has a camera just above Mario's hat so that it's facing forward. You hook everything up. You set up in your living room or your den or your, you know, semi-finished
any
basement,
flat surface,
anywhere, you know, these gates, right, that the Mario Kart car will drive through. And then the game and the camera and the Nintendo Switch together all create a racetrack that then you can drive around and have great fun in your very own domicile. So how cool is this, Michael, in terms of an AR game that is now engaging people on a completely new level?
I think it's very cool, and it reminds me of the fun I had at WWDC a couple of years ago with the AR kit game that they gave you the source code to do little slingshots to knock over fake wooden blocks.
Right.
But, you know, that was a technology demo. This is a game. This is fun. Right. And I was reading the article and watching the video, and the guy was talking about how you lay out the tracks, the gates, you drive it once so that the game can register location information, and then it renders out a Mario game, right? I mean, Mario Kart game. And my favorite point was, he's like, when you're sitting there and you're playing it and you're looking down on the little screen and you're flying through the gates at breakneck speed, and it's all the fun that you expect at the video game. And then you look up and you see the little car going me around the house, because it's slow. It's all perspective, right? I mean, you got a little, if you're 2 inches tall, you're flying. But if you're, let's say, average 5'8", you know, the differences make it really slow. So it's the perfect realization of an AR game with the experience focusing you down to be the little guy in the car. Very cool.
Yep, I love it. And we'll have a couple of examples coming up here shortly in the show where this same kind of technology and capability would apply really well. But before we get there, our friend Ian, who is probably also playing Mario Kart as we speak.
Probably.
based on the tweets and such that we've seen, shared a sneak peek of the augmented reality game Epic Marble. And this kind of reminded me a little bit, Michael, of that very first game, one of the very first games on the iPhone. What was it? Marble Madness
or Marble something Madness like that? Marble Madness or something like that, yeah.
So the example here is you have this marble. It shows in front of you with the phone in AR, and you have to navigate said marble using the camera lens from your beginning point to a target point. And very, very cool, right? A little more interactive than Mario. Not Mario, but Pokemon Go.
What really impressed me on it, so this is using Unity and using the newest iPad Pro.
Yep.
And it'll also have the same features with the new iPhone 12 with the LiDAR camera. And the reason the LiDAR camera is so important, when you watch the demo video on Twitter, they're showing things passing in front and behind the AR object. Mm-hmm. And this is one of the things that was called out by Apple recently at their announcement on Tuesday of the new gaming capabilities with ARKit in the iPhone 12 with LiDAR, which shows you how cool that will be, right? Because not only do you have a depth map that allows you to position virtual things behind and in front of physical things, but you also have a point cloud map with very detailed distance data so that the marble can stick, right? So you don't have the jitter or the shake that you might see in some AR games or applications while it's remapping and understanding the physical environment that the AR object is sitting on. So very, very cool. I looked at the tweet. I watched the video. I didn't get when this will be available or if it was truly only a demo.
It's only a model. It's only a marble.
It's only an AR marble.
It's only an AR marble. I love this. Oh man. Okay. So now let's go to the reason for our title of the show this week. This The Verge article around augmented reality is so incredible because it's not just for people anymore. It's for man's best friend as well. Augmented reality goggles for dogs.
Yeah, this is really neat. So one of the challenges with canine units in military operations is the relationship between the handler and the dog requires close contact.
Yep.
And so the basic idea is by providing AR capabilities for the animal, you're able to control the dog at much greater distances while the handler is in a safe, hidden position. So, you know, there's dogs that do things like sniffing for landmines, mm-hmm. right? And you want to make sure that, I mean, you don't want to lose the dog. That's not the point here, but it's about safety and operational integrity of the human controlling the dog. And to me, what's interesting about this, because they're so highly censored to get data, is I can see them taking this data from a real canine unit out in a field environment and using that to feed into the systems of the robotic canines that we've seen from Boston Dynamics for forever.
Ooh.
Right?
You took that in a neat way. That's very appropriate, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah. But it allows you to give visual and auditory clues or commands to the dog at great distance. It allows, like I said, the human to be safely hidden. If they can shrink, I mean, if I'm walking around in a hostile environment and I see a dog coming up with shades on, I'm going to worry anyway, right?
You should.
Yeah.
You should.
But it's one hip-looking dog.
Yeah, you know, the things that I was thinking about was the remote viewing capability. You know, mm-hmm. So now you have the Mario Kart on a dog, and granted, our dog is not running around a race, but you could see, and you can see from a dog's eye perspective, which sometimes is going to be a little bit different than what you would see from someone who's standing five and a half, 6 feet tall.
Or from a Mario Kart.
Yeah, or from a Mario
perspective.
Kart. Yeah, so that I thought was pretty incredible. The notion of providing cues and clues, gotta say that three times fast, could be really interesting because you can light up things that you would like the dog to take a closer look at, which would be, yeah, which be a little bit different too than how a handler might not ordinarily be. And I was wondering too if there'd be a canine version of bone conduction, you know, to give the auditory clues here too, because yeah, well, you wouldn't necessarily want that to be out loud saying, "Hey, there's that guy over there. He looks sketchy. Go sniff him."
Yeah, but I mean, think about it. You could do dog whistles, literal dog whistles, not the. But the other thing that's interesting, you said paint things.
Yeah.
Did you ever play StarCraft?
No, I have watched a little bit, but no.
So one of the guys in StarCraft, and I can't remember which faction it was, had the laser pointer that he would paint a target, and then a missile would rain down on it. So
yeah,
that's, well, when you said paint, that's exactly what
a forward observer could do, that sort of thing, yeah. And a dog could, you know, identify what, you know, needs to be targeted that way, in a very intriguing way. So we've talked about dogs, we've talked about Mario Kart. We're now on the drone front. We have to do coffee next. But this new, actually, it's not that new, but there's this concept here around using drones to track production progress, flying around cameras with AI and being able to view from afar how things are going and being able to scale those models up. So it's kind of a combination of AR, AI, and the whole digital twin structure as the structure is being created. I thought this was really pretty cool.
Yeah, this is interesting. Years ago, I worked with some teams that were doing some interesting stuff with drones and visual inspection and mapping. It's interesting to see this concept become more and more of a reality in multiple stages of the life cycle of, in this case, it's a plant, right? Mm-hmm. Or some large construction. I saw recently a video online of bridge inspection on the largest bridge in, I think, Denmark? Could have been the Netherlands. Largest suspension bridge over water, and how they were using drones and visual recognition to map and understand the health of the bridge.
Oh yeah.
So there's lots of great examples of this. You have to use AR. You have to use AI for this stuff. I mean, just because you can map the object, you can't necessarily understand the state of the object without some kind of learning algorithm, some kind of visual recognition or AR capabilities to do that. And mapping these stages of a construction site, again, it's not about the picture. It's about the picture over time.
Yes.
Right?
Right.
And that's where the insight comes in. So this is, you know, perfect example, really good example of things that have been coming for some time, and it's nice to see this one and what they're doing if it along with the other ones that I saw.
Love it. It makes perfect sense, Michael, and building those things up over time, you know, those are the deltas that would help you also identify, you know, where should you be right now as you're making your progress, and that would help with doing what's necessary, that you don't necessarily need a human out there looking at everything for inspection. And frankly, a human eye is not necessarily going to find all those anyway, right? You yep. need to look at it from different directions. Our next story is one that takes Michael, you and me back in our Wayback Machine, and I don't know that we'll be able to find it, but I know we talked about the concept of artificially intelligent immortality, the idea that because you and I have been on, you know, one or two podcasts here over the years, and
couple
shared a few thoughts over the years, that in theory you could ingest those, interpret them, and even after we're long gone, or we stop podcasting, or we're long gone and we've stopped podcasting, you could still interact.
I might continue to podcast after I'm long gone.
Well, that could be the thing, right? You know, it could be that some future technology emerges, and Michael will talk about it based upon what could be inferred from what we might think about it. So, story file. A really interesting notion is it uses artificial intelligence to capture a series of interview questions and answers that then allows for a third party after the fact to interact with you, even though the you is not you, it's a recording of you.
So I actually heard a couple of people talk about this earlier, and you know, the idea was, based off of all of your existing digital footprint out on the web, they were doing something very similar to this, and they were doing interviews or articles written in your style.
Mm-hmm.
That would be, you know, yes, Michael hasn't said a comment about this, but if he did, this is what it would sound like.
Mm-hmm.
And it took me back to... I don't know if you've watched any of Star Trek Lower Decks.
Only a little bit from what we talked about in the beginning. I've not jumped into the CBS All Access piece. So the beginning of the first episode or two.
Yeah, I'm not gonna give away the whole story. one of the very last episodes of the first season. One of the Lower Decks personnel programs the holodeck to act like all the people on board so that he can prepare for an interview.
Oh, okay. Okay. Well, that's clever. I like that. Yeah.
Right? Which all fits into this story, right? And hilarity ensues. But I find it interesting that we're starting to get to the point, at least in the Mechanical Turk sort of way, right? Mm-hmm. Or the Turing sort of way, where there is enough of a digital footprint to where using AI, you can get answers that are at least expected based off of the history of the digital content of the person you're talking to.
Yes. And... If you think about this in terms of instructor-led education, right, which we know has many advantages over passive learning type of education, watch this video, read this thing, you can imagine where a lecturer who has now been recorded plenty of times talking about quantum physics, talking about bioethics, talking about whatever it might be, you could then interact with that professor in a one-to-one type of environment, taking advantage of this. And,
yes.
And if you apply on top of that some of the deep fake visual augmentation that we've talked about on the show plenty of times here recently, it could be a very realistic experience. I mean, we're all experiencing that right now, you know, over our digital video conferencing kind of meetings too. You might actually be interacting with a clone, a digital clone of someone else, so that you can maximize their impact and their effort.
What's funny is this kind of goes back into I've recently, my wife picked up a book for me, one that was in my list to read, The Diamond Age.
I was thinking about that too.
and it kind of takes you down that same path, right? Because the primer does that, except at the time that was written, the best we could do was use reactives.
Yes.
Right? To actually become that voice in the computer to give you the education. And now We are getting closer and closer to that dynamic education tool, as you're describing it, with things like AI, the history of all these great speakers and presenters turned into an education experience. And the question that I have, though, is if we go down that path, how do we ensure, not insure, but ensure, that the next generation of great speakers get the opportunity to speak and to learn how to speak and to give the presentations that eventually can be fed back into the system to improve education to the next level?
Ooh, very, very meta of you, Michael.
That's my job.
And I'm glad that you didn't use the product placement for Ensure for this as well.
No, I remember really early on in my career working on an RFP and being told, you never, ever use INSURE because you are not insuring anything. You may sometimes be okay using ENSURE.
Yes, but not insure unless you are providing an insurance policy for something.
Exactly.
Well, it's our policy on this show to talk a lot about games. And yes. And this next article kind of spans a nice arc from what we talked about with Mark, not to rhyme on purpose there, but to think about longstanding video games, the code behind them, and making them available. So, Michael, set this article up for us about thinking about the source code for your favorite game.
Yeah, and I actually was going to ask what your favorite game was from back then that you would like to do this to. This article from The Verge is really about a project called the Video Game Source Project, led by Frank Cafferty, I can't pronounce the last name, and Kelsey Lewin, and part of the Video Game History Foundation. And what they've done is it's not just about finding the source code, but think about it as an archaeological dig, right? You can find the mummy and go, oh, there's a mummy. But from a history perspective, building the story behind the mummy and who the person was and what they did and how they lived and how they died, etc. And so what they've been doing is looking at various games. And there was a big leak, evidently, recently of a bunch of source code of older games. Mm-hmm. That I guess it was the Nintendo Giga Leak, as they call it.
Yep.
But they were looking at the game The Secret of Monkey Island. Okay, and I don't know if you've ever played that one.
Never did.
Gosh, I want to say 10 or more years ago, there was a Mac port of it that I played for a while. And it was on one of these, yes, when you shipped DVDs full of games, right? It was on one of those. I don't know if it was a sampler or whatever. Anyway, they were looking at the source code, and they came upon a part of the source code where there's a snippet of code blowing up a bridge. And they're like, I played the game. Nowhere in that game is there a bridge blowing up. What Yep. does this mean? Was this something in the design that they went through and decided actively not to do? And so they actually went back to the original developers and asked about it. And the history actually is, well, it was a pretty big project team. We had a group of people that didn't have anything to do at that phase. So we said, hey, go figure out about, you know, sabotaging the bridge. And so they had them work on that just to give them something to do while they were working the story. Because the great thing about games like The Secret of Monkey Island is a story game, right? Mm-hmm. And you really have to get the design of the story and the flow of the story done before you can flesh out the game. And so it's interesting. It goes back to the discussion we had last week with Mark on, could you really understand the code and what it all means? I mean, if you replicate this game now, would you port that code of a bridge blowing up? that has nothing to do with any part of the game. It's not accessible in the game. It's not an Easter egg, you know?
And it's in there.
It's just some code that was left in there from an early design phase of giving a small group of people something to do so they didn't sit around and twiddle their thumbs.
It's like the deleted scenes from a movie, right, that were left on the cutting room floor.
No, and somehow, not at all. Because those are part of a larger potential story. And then you say, to fit in time and scope and the flow, you cut them out.
Yeah.
This is, go find me a rock. And while you're doing that, we're going to have these guys start building a house out of wood. You're going to come back and say, I got a rock, and we're going to say, thank you, and we're going to keep working on the wood. So it was true and complete busy work. So if you're porting your favorite game from way back in the day, you find the source code.
Mm.
Do you understand all aspects of the game, or are you doing a technical exercise of just porting code? And then you have this piece of code. You can't test it because it's never going to be executed. It's a chunk of code in the middle of a game that's never used. So it's an interesting story, and they're actually on October 30th they're going to do a live stream about some of the work that they're doing with the Video Game History Foundation, and I'm hoping that I have time to watch it, because it sounds really, really cool. I love the idea of going back, and I was thinking back, you know, to some of the seminal games that I spent lots of time with when I was young that I would love to do this to. Joust,
yep,
was fun. The one that really got me, and this is going to sound so cliche, was Space Invaders, the original Space Invaders. And I remember I was, I think I was in junior high. I was on a bowling league. The bowling alley was, a couple of blocks from the house, so I could walk to the bowling alley. And they had the table video games, right, that were flat on top, and you had the screen that you looked down into. And Space Invaders got my heart racing. Right.
Hmm.
It was the game you could hide
underneath, those areas and be safe until you had to jump out.
No, it wasn't that. It was as you started wiping them out, they got faster and faster and came down quicker and quicker.
Oh, yeah. And
I mean, there was an accelerate and the music change. Yeah. It was a rush that you would get. And the first time after, I don't know how many quarters I dropped in it, but the first time I cleared the first level. Right? You know, yeah, exactly. Arms up in the air, woo! Right? And you're in a bowling lane. Or bowling alley, not in the lane. So that sound, boom, 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 right? That acceleration of, I'm going nuts. I'm losing the word that I'm thinking of.
It's the adrenaline. Tempo.
The adrenaline rush and all that. All of that comes together in an experience, even now just thinking about it and talking about it. And I guarantee you, if I had the code without all that other history, would it have the same feeling looking at the source code? So I'm trying to think of what's the game that I'd love to get the source code and try to recreate that experience, but on newer platforms and newer capabilities.
Hmm.
So I thought it was really, really cool. I'm looking forward to October 30th. I hope I have time to watch their live stream.
That does sound like a lot of fun, and I know we're getting close on time here for this episode too. But when you said, "Hey, Michael, what's your favorite?" I wrote down three, and then I added two more after you said Space Invaders. So the three that I wrote, funny for me, were quarter based games too. I used to play a lot of Gauntlet. Elf needs food badly.
Oh yes,
I used to play,
and you kept throwing quarters in.
Yep, I used to play a lot of Rampage, and I thought that was just so funny, where you got to be, you know, this big terrifying monster that would go smash up buildings and, you know,
and then eating people.
And I played an awful lot of Indiana Jones, where you had to do a variety of things in order
Spy
to
Spy Hunter.
I liked that, and I played that like on an Apple, but the other two that you reminded me about. were Missile Command and Centipede.
Centipede. You know, oh, yeah, that was another good one.
I wound up playing those a lot, too, on Atari devices and other places. And it was just like, you know, how much fun were these things, right?
Yeah. Yeah, I was thinking when I got to college, there was a video arcade in the student center that had video games and pool tables and ping pong tables. And there was a karate game.
Karateka?
I think that might have been it. And there was a three-thing move that would let me clear the bad guy every time. And it was another ones where it was just constantly getting harder and harder, and you kept dropping quarters in, right? So, Elf needs food badly.
Yeah.
Drop some more quarters.
I liked playing the Elf versus the Wizard, and I was never a happy tank player, so. Or the Valkyrie. Here. I would play the Valkyrie sometimes, Valkyrie too, but I liked the Elf. Elf needs
see,
food
I was the Wizard.
Badly.
Wizard and the Valkyrie, but...
Cool. Well, that's where we got to leave it for today, I'm afraid. An interesting set of conversations today. And boy, if you can't wait for the next set, as we can't, drop us a line. Send us a flare.
Tell your friends.
A tweet would be good. Tell a friend. And your topics may well show up on our next episode of
Games at Work. Biz.
See everybody.
Bye.
You've been listening to GamesAtWork.biz, the podcast about gaming technology and play. We are part of the Blueberry Podcasting Network, and would like to thank the band Random Encounters for their song, Big Blue. You can follow us on Twitter at GamesAtWork_biz or at our website at GamesAtWork.biz.